Good morning and welcome to Politics Up Close on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Healthcare reform is near and dear to the heart of one particular candidate running for the Utah Senate this election year. That's because Dr. Brian Shiozawa has been an emergency room physician for more than 20 years and is past president of the Utah Medical Association. The Republican is running in Senate District 8, including cities like Cottonwood Heights, Midvale, and Murray, which is an open seat being vacated by retiring Democrat Karen Morgan. He joins me now in the studio to talk about his experience, why he's looking to get into politics, and what he'd like to accomplish as a state lawmaker. And Dr. Shiozawa, it's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here as well.
Well, Brian, is this your first time getting involved in politics? And if so, why did you decide to do it?
This is the first time I have actually ever run for a political office. Now, I've been involved working with the governor and other governors on the Capitol Hill with health-related events for literally several years. But this is the first time I've actually pursued an elected office.
And why did you decide that this was the right time to do it?
There were a number of things that led me to this decision at this particular point. And frankly, from a very practical standpoint, I'm at a point in my career where after over 20 years of emergency medicine, I can take some time now in the practice to devote it to other areas, most specifically to this political endeavor and seeking office.
Tell me a little bit about your career in medicine and what you've been doing for the past several years as an emergency physician.
Well, my professional background is I did my college work at Stanford and went to medical school at the University of Washington. Then I came here to the University of Utah and actually did a residency in family practice. And at that time, I was able to also train and prepare for boards in emergency medicine. So I have the unique background of being both boarded in family practice and emergency medicine. So that's been my professional background and training as far as that goes. For over 20 years, I've been at St. Mark's Hospital working in the emergency department. And we've built that from a group of four physicians up to its current group of 23 doctors, providing all the emergency care for that particular hospital.
And has being a physician given you business experience as well? When you're a doctor, you know, you kind of need both medical experience and some business savvy as well, I'm sure.
You know, you're absolutely right. We have a group now in our own group of 23 doctors, and we've merged that group with Epic. And so we have over 100 emergency physicians in 9 emergency departments all up and down the Wasatch Front. So we have to provide for our doctors a salary, benefits. We have to take care of their families. We have to balance the books and make sure that we take care of our business just like any other business does.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Dr. Brian Shiozawa. He's the Republican candidate running in Utah Senate District 8. So you mentioned coming to the University of Utah. Was that your first experience in the state?
No, we have relatives here, and so we always visited here. I grew up in Idaho, so not far from here. And so, no, we love the state of Utah. In fact, I almost came here to medical school and just made the hard choice to go to the University of Washington instead. So, no, our hearts are near and dear to this great state.
So, as I mentioned, Senate District 8 is a pretty interesting area. Cottonwood Heights, Midvale, and Murray, even parts of Holiday and Sandy, I believe. It includes, you know, Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon. What do you think are some of the unique concerns of residents of this district, Brian, as you're running for this job?
There are just lots of areas of concern and interest. This is a very engaged, active group of constituents and families. Some of the things that I've been working on particularly have been addressed to that. Strong education, keeping our jobs growing, and employment for our own citizens and our families so that our own children, our grandchildren have a place to go. And also health care. We're all concerned about health care, the cost of health care, access, quality, where it's going to go this next year.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about being involved up at the Capitol as an advocate on healthcare-related issues. Tell me a little bit more about how you first got involved in that.
Well, the very first time I went up to the Hill was years ago when I was trying to get legislation passed to help protect our emergency medical technicians, our EMS people, when they're on the job, to protect them from lawsuits so that they could go out and practice and do their care without fear of being sued. And that introduced me to the concepts of what it's like to be engaged on the Hill with legislators and the process of what it's like to create legislation that benefits all of our society.
Was it a challenging process, do you think, when you were trying to get the attention of these state lawmakers? What did you learn about the process when you did that?
It's a totally different process than, say, working in the emergency department because people come from such different backgrounds. But the one thing I was impressed with was that people do resonate with when it's the right thing, when they perceive it's the best thing for the social good, and then they will back that. And we were able to pursue that and create some very meaningful changes. And that was many years ago. And then over the past years, I've been even more involved.
So, as I mentioned, you're immediate past president of the Utah Medical Association. What have you done in that role, and why did you decide to serve in that group?
There were a couple things that we did legislatively that really interest me and engaged me in this process. One was a House bill that was really, on the surface, seemed fairly minor, but the impact was huge. For example, when people go to the doctor, they often come home with important prescriptions like for their blood pressure or diabetes, maybe for their heart problems. And they go to the pharmacy and they find they can't afford it. And so a significant percentage of those prescriptions never get filled. So we were able to pass legislation that allowed physicians to prescribe medication and give them samples, free samples in the office, not just for 3 days as currently is allowed under the DOPL regulations, but up to 30 or 60 days. Now, these are medicines that are important for people who are on fixed incomes, who don't have insurance, or who simply don't have the money of the hundreds of dollars it might cost. And these can be life-changing, important medications in their lives. It seemed like a small deal at the time, but yet its impact can be very far-reaching in the practical lives of people. It was the last bill that got passed in that session, but it was a big bill.
One thing that you mentioned on your website, also having advocated for, Brian, is preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, one of the great things that I see in medicine, both as emergency doc and as a family practice trained doctor, is that unique bond that exists between a physician and the patient. No one knows can feel that degree of trust unless that's been developed over the years. And then that leads to better health care, better access. And then I think that trust also helps us to provide the care that patients need in their families, their extended families, and keep costs down. Frankly, keeps litigation less and helps us to do the job, frankly, in a partnership more than just a business relationship or a physician-client relationship.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Dr. Brian Shiozawa, immediate past president of the Utah Medical Association and a candidate for the Utah Senate in District 8, the Republican nominee. The district includes cities like Cottonwood Heights, Midvale, and Murray. So, Brian, what do you think are the biggest healthcare challenges facing Utah right now? What do you see as the biggest problems that are still on the table that have yet to be resolved?
You know, Jeff, there's a number of things that are huge right now that we need to look at. One of them is the sheer cost of medical care. Right now, even though I believe the quality of the medical care in this state is great and that we have good physicians and very good relationships with our patients, the costs are just way too high and they're unsustainable and unaffordable. And that's one huge thing that we need to address. Another thing is we don't have enough access to for our patients. And so, for example, if you don't have insurance or if you're on Medicaid or maybe you have regular commercial insurance, you may not be able to get into your doctor's office because they are so backed up or so packed. And so where do you go when you're sick? Well, you may be able to go to an urgent care. But if you don't have money or you don't have the right insurance, you don't have even that access point. And so where they end up? They end up in the emergency department, which is the most expensive place to get health care and, frankly, not the best place.
And are Utah emergency rooms pretty overtaxed from what you've seen?
There's many days when our wait times are not only 1 hour, but more than 1 hour in the emergency department. And granted, that's better than some big cities where I trained, but that's still not the right way to treat patients.
What do you think of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act? Obviously, something that we've seen staunch opposition to in Utah, but I'm interested in your perspective as a doctor. Are there both positives and negatives from your perspective? Is it mostly all negative? What do you think about the consequences?
This is a truly historic landmark piece of legislation. Mm. Right now, we are at a point in our lives where the decisions we make, both as citizens and community and estate, are going to impact us and, frankly, our families for generations potentially. Now, getting back specifically to the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. there are some things personally that I think are very favorable about the act. For example, I'm grateful that the Affordable Care Act limits the exclusions from pre-existing conditions. Mm. That was one problem that was really a stumbling block for people. So they couldn't qualify for insurance because of some minor, relatively minor problem in the past. And so that, just taking the pre-existing conditions exclusion out, I think was a very positive step. I like the idea of young adults being insured up through age 26. That creates a coverage for a vulnerable group of people. Now, this group of people, for the most part, are young and they're healthy and mm-hmm. they do fine. But they're also very active, and injuries and illness can happen quickly and they can be catastrophic. And to deny this group of people insurance because either they can't afford it or they haven't gotten it, extending to 26, I think, is a very positive aspect of the Affordable Care Act. Now, the one thing that is on the minds of a lot of people is the expansion of Medicaid, and I'd like to talk a little more about that.
Sure.
Because that is an area that is real controversial and does in and of itself have some pros, but it has also some cons. So I'd like to also be able to talk to you about that. So those are some of the things that in this Affordable Care Act are truly historic and that we as a community, we as citizens, and we as a state really need to take very seriously because the long-term consequences are huge. We are actually at a branch point, I think, in our medical care. For example, if we embrace the Affordable Care Act and we decide we're going to go forth with this, we will probably be steering eventually to more a single-payer type of insurance because we'll have not only a larger Medicaid population but also the pre-existing Medicare population. And then we'll have to look at the financial consequences of that. And some people call these entitlements because of various aspects of those. And so those are also some things that are going to be huge for us as a state to look at.
And, Brian, let's go right into the issue you brought up then, the Medicaid expansion, which is left to debate now that the Supreme Court has ruled that the federal government cannot require states to do this Medicaid expansion. Where do you come down on that decision? Because it will be up to the legislature to decide whether to expand eligibility for Medicaid or not. What are the pros and cons you refer to?
Well, as it's currently stated to the state of Utah, with the expansion to go to 133 or 138%, depending on whatever your figures are, mm-hmm. of the federal poverty level, that will embrace a much larger group of Medicaid-eligible patients at that time. Estimates are anywhere from 50,000 up to 105,000. And the pros on that are that would help seal those holes, those access points, make the safety net even broader and more comprehensive. And so from a social standpoint, that would be more comprehensive and really protect these people, hence the name Affordable Care Act, and it's mm-hmm. also patient protective. Now, the other thing to think about on that is if we do that, how are we going to be able to take care of this group of patients? And that's where there's some cautions that come to mind. One of them is, do we have the infrastructure to take care of all these patients? Mm. For example, I don't know that we have enough Medicaid clinics to take another 50,000 or 105,000 Utahns. They're already taxed. And so one of the things I would propose as a solution, should this state go forth on the Medicaid expansion, is to take our current community clinics, increase the staffing on those clinics, mm. and use even mid-level providers with physician-directed teams so we could keep up quality and outcomes, and yet still keep it affordable. And from a very personal standpoint, what that would mean is patients could go in on the same day, maybe with extended hours, even perhaps on weekends, and be seen rather than having to go to the ER, which is multiples more expensive. In other words, mm-hmm. when you go with your child to an emergency department, your bill could be thousands of dollars, or it'd be a tiny fraction of that in a Medicaid clinic for really very similar care and from someone you know. Now, wouldn't that be better? And so from that standpoint, I think we have to look at our infrastructure and how we're going to do that. So in other words, not just to enact a program, but also to be able to have that infrastructure to support that program and do it responsibly.
Can you say right now whether you would be in favor of the Medicaid expansion or whether you would vote against it?
What I would do is, and not dodging this question, mm-hmm. I would really like to seal the safety net in terms of making it adequately protective. So, for example, if you're a hardworking adult and you simply cannot afford your insurance or it's not provided by your employer, that there is still an affordable mechanism. And if Medicaid is the answer, if Medicaid expansion is the answer, then so be it. But I would like to see some affordable alternatives so that when we go home from work after working all day in a fast food, in whatever type of job that we're involved with, and yet we make so much that we don't qualify under the current Medicaid, state Medicaid rules, mm-hmm. we would still have that opportunity and not be denied medical care or at least have that opportunity. So this is one thing I would like to propose, and that is to look at our existing state Medicaid requirements and eligibility and expand that to such an amount that at 100% poverty level, we can embrace this. And then we can look at the implications of that and the patient population and take care of those patients who are not currently being helped. One of the attractive things about the 133% on the Medicaid expansion is mm-hmm. that it embraces a much larger group of people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wonderful. The problem with 133%, even though the federal government is going to match that almost completely for 2 years, and then there's a substantial match even over the next 8 years, is that eventually the state is going to be held liable for fractions of that, kind of like a sliding scale.
Right.
And so then we'll build a population of 105,000 or more because our state is growing. You know, when I applied to medical school, there were 2 million Utahns, and the medical school admitted 100 students. Mm-hmm. Now there are 3 million Utahns, and the medical school admits 80 students.
Wow.
And we are, frankly, we're underserved. Huh. And so we need to create infrastructure. We need to create a system that we can take care of our patients. So we don't just say, okay, everybody's eligible, but we don't create a place for them to go. Or frankly, they will come into the emergency department. And that's not the best place to have your care.
This is Politics Up Close. I'm speaking with Dr. Brian Shiozawa. He's the Republican candidate for Utah Senate District 8. And we will be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Politics Up Close here on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson, speaking this hour with Dr. Brian Shiozawa. He's a candidate for Utah Senate District 8, the GOP nominee. The district includes cities like Cottonwood Heights, Murray, and Midvale, and the Little and Big Cottonwood Canyons. And Brian, we were talking before the break about Medicaid and this possible expansion of Medicaid. I'm curious, do you think you perhaps have a different perspective of people who are on Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program than other Republicans might? We've seen, you know, from some people, and not necessarily the entire party or anything, but, you know, this idea that people who are on public assistance perhaps are not motivated to improve their situation or perhaps shouldn't be on public assistance. Do you think you might have a unique perspective on people who are on Medicaid and whether they're truly desperate people?
From my particular profession, I work in an emergency department, mm-hmm. and almost 40% of the patients that I see every day have either no insurance or they're on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And then even a greater proportion of our Medicare patients. So we certainly see a lot of people on either government assistance insurance or frankly have no insurance. So I think that does give me a unique, even among physicians, a unique perspective on demographics and the needs of our populations. We take care of these patients day and night. Mm-hmm. We see them on weekends and holidays. And so we can see into their lives and we can sit down with them and with their families and take care of them. And frankly, it's a privilege. Emergency medicine is something that I've loved. I'm glad I've had the privilege of doing it for over 20 years. But we also see the heartbreak. We also see those sorts of personal tragedies that come because people don't have access or they delay their care or they simply don't have care. And because of that, I think it does give me a unique perspective among even healthcare professionals in terms of the Medicaid population. You know, Jeff, the other thing, though, having said that, I think sometimes, though, we as a group of people tend to describe others. And as a Republican, for example, let me just say I never want to see an uninsured patient. Yeah. I don't want to see people go hungry. I don't want to see people suffer. I don't want to see families bankrupted because they went to the hospital and their costs because of a pregnancy or an injury overwhelms them and they lose their house. Nobody likes to see that. Mm-hmm. And I think we all, as whether we're red, blue, I think we're all red, white, and blue, and we want the best for our fellow citizens. And I embrace that. I think we have to work together and have good bipartisan support because just for that reason, we want the best for our patient population. And that's really my interest in all of this.
Mm-hmm. One more healthcare question before we move on. Where do you come down on the individual mandate to purchase health insurance? As an emergency room physician, I would imagine you'd see people coming in to be treated for, you know, non-emergency type conditions because they simply have nowhere else to go if they don't have insurance. What do you think of that mandate?
You know, when I first heard about the mandate, my initial reaction was this was a real intrusion by the federal government into people's lives because it said you have to do something and that you have to buy insurance. In fact, that was part of the genesis of the Tea Party movement, frankly, sort of requiring people to do something, almost a taxation without representation or at least infringing on individual rights. And I still believe that we as a people are pretty intelligent. We know what we should do and what we shouldn't do. Now, having said that, there is clearly a group of our population that does not have health care. And when they come into the hospital emergency department or when they go to the clinic and they don't have health insurance, they suffer. And then that ripple effect to the rest part of the society, whether it's through cost shifting, through the effects on their family, their loved ones, through volunteer organizations like their churches or charitable societies, is huge. And that's based on an individual decision. So I have actually embraced the idea that people have the responsibility to take care of themselves and get insurance. And I would like to have affordable insurance so that this is not an onerous burden to somebody and so that it doesn't become a big deal in terms of individual liberties. I still stand by the fact that I think we're pretty smart and we can make our own decisions. If I had to do it over, I would not have the individual mandate. So people can make own intelligent, wise decisions. But for that vulnerable population that may not be able to make that decision, who don't have the information, then I would say, then let's create a system by which it is so affordable, so accessible, that it can be easily provided to them. And so that would be a good bipartisan approach that would help not only our society, but also to ease that conscience of, or the burden of other people who are worried about individual freedoms being threatened.
Dr. Shiozawa, let's move on to a different topic that I'm sure will be important in this race and many others, public education. It's a topic you talk about on your campaign website. Where do you see the biggest deficiencies right now, and are there any particular ideas you want to bring to this race on that front?
Well, there are multiple deficiencies in our public education as we look at it. However, that is not to be construed as a criticism of our teachers or their efforts or our schools. What I'm concerned about is we have classroom sizes that are not sustainable. When a good teacher who's dedicated, who dedicates his or her life to teaching, and then faces a classroom of 30 or 40 children or more, without teacher's aides, without adequate supplies, that's not right in a state of ours. We should have small, reasonable classroom sizes so our teachers can do the job that they're trained to do. And frankly, I look at teaching as a calling. I think they do this as something to help children, and they do it with sincerity and, I think, dedication for the most part. Another area is we have the lowest WPUs in the country, and we need to look at that because I recognize, like you, I believe that education is so strategically important. You know, when we look at education, it's either the first step into getting your career after high school, or it launches you into higher education. And frankly, we need good education because it provides that educated base of people that are going to be important for us to sustain our businesses. That was one of the great things in Utah before is we had a well-educated population. So companies wanted to come to Utah because our people are motivated, they're hardworking, they want to contribute to the businesses, and frankly, they're well-educated. Now, do we still have that? And that's the question we have to ask. So those from a strategic standpoint, we need to keep up that excellence in our schooling.
Do you believe it all comes down then to lack of funding? And do you think there are any ways to raise education funding? Would you support even as much as an income tax increase, or should there be another method in place?
There's funding is clearly at the root of a lot of these problems. If we had more money to do adequate classrooms, for example, if we had a little more money, we could hire teacher's aides, much like a physician assistant might work with a physician, mm-hmm. someone who could expand that coverage and accessibility for those students so they get that individual attention and still work together as a team. So I'd like to see us get more teacher's aides involved in that. But all that costs money. And I believe that we can scrutinize our educational system. There's probably some efficiencies that could be addressed, and we could probably do that. But I think the schools, for the most part, and the various schools that I've been able to visit with, the various school boards, are working hard on that. They're mindful of the cost of education. Mm-hmm. They're mindful of their cost of administration. So I don't think that efficiency is going to be the whole answer. So then we have to look at alternative funds. And I know some people have talked about state lands, reclamation of state lands in terms of state control.
Right.
I think that's a wonderful idea, but is it realistic? Mm-hmm. And can we realize that in the time frame, say, for example, with our children, are they going to still be children and in the public schools by the time that's realized? So I agree with that concept, but I'm not sure how applicable that is. Now, Utah has the state the CITLA program, which has worked pretty well. And I'd like to see that continue because that brings in millions of dollars into our state coffers. One of the other things that we haven't discussed is the impact of business and the revenues. Mm-hmm. For the first time in many years, we've seen a revenue surplus this year that they're trying to allocate to various organizations in need within the states. And I think that's wonderful. Partly that's due to the improving business economy, increasing taxes that have come from tax revenues. And so stimulating our business with the basis of a strong educational system and then building our business and then bringing those additional revenues to the state is another source. I think we have to look back to it as some constitutional changes that took place in the mid-1990s, wherein there was a change in the allocation of the school revenue or the income taxes and between K-12 and higher education. I think we need to look at that as well as an option. Now, just like anybody else, I don't want to see us pay a cent more in taxes than we absolutely have to. But like anybody else who's reasonable, is raising taxes an option? Well, it may have to be. But I would look at efficiencies, increasing other revenues, looking perhaps at exemptions that may be given out that may be not the best thing in our state's interests. We should look at those. And then we could look at taxes as another alternative. I think we have to take the approach of we'll look at the entire picture, recognizing the overreaching needs, which is excellence in our schools, protecting our students, making that a safety net that's relevant. You know, when you talk about some of the schools that don't have enough money, without education, we're going to see higher crime rates, we're going to see dropouts, we're going to see various groups of students who, frankly, will become disadvantaged from an early age and that may not be recoverable because of what? Because of lack of good education. So we have to embrace that safety net and that importance of public schools as providing that.
This is Politics Up Close. My guest is Dr. Brian Chiozawa. We have a couple minutes left with him. He's the Republican nominee in Utah Senate District 8 from Cottonwood Heights. That district includes some of the surrounding cities as well, Murray and Midvale, to name a few. Brian, going back to one specific health care issue, because it's something that's been a topic of much debate in the past couple of years, and that's insurance coverage for children with autism in Utah, something I'm sure you've had the opportunity to study. There have been proposals to say, for example, insurance companies must cover autism treatment. There is also an autism treatment pilot program for a limited number of children with autism in the state. Where do you come down on this, and what do you think might need to be done for these families that need this help?
Well, first of all, we now recognize autism as a legitimate, understandable, identifiable problem. Mm-hmm. We understand it as a disease that can be, if addressed early through prevention and early intervention, the results can be amazing. And that makes a lot of sense to me. Now, just like everybody else, I probably don't like the idea of being told what to do or mandates. But, you know, when we consider as we looked at the 10 parts of the essential benefits plan that came under the PEHP that was recently approved by the legislature, autism was one of those areas that wasn't addressed. And there are other areas, though, that are addressed: maternity, inpatient, emergency department care. And there are disease entities which, frankly, we do mandate care for. So I think we need to relook at autism as a disease that, that should be addressed. From a dollars and cents standpoint, it just makes good sense. If we can do interventions that are, as we call in medicine, evidence-based, in other words, we embrace good, solid treatments on an early basis, with those early interventions which cost relatively small amounts of money, we can prevent lifelong problems or mitigate those problems and save ourselves a lot of money in that sense. So from a physical standpoint, it makes good sense. And from a standpoint of recognizing that as a disease that can be treated, I think we need to take the step forward. I agree with the pilot program, and it'd be interesting to see how that, that fleshes out. But it, the, unfortunately, the group of clients in that is still relatively small. And so it would be nice to expand that so that we can see that as a state and help those many autistic patients. If you believe that figure, 1 in 47, which I think is a remarkably high figure, I'd like to see that restudied because that's amazing that that's so high in Utah. But nevertheless, embracing that as a fairly prevalent disease, then we certainly have to look at this as a very treatable but identifiable and, frankly, problem that needs to be addressed now and something that's urgent.
In the last couple of minutes in our interview, Brian, let's address the campaign for this seat itself. Your opponent is a Democrat, Josie Valdez. This is an open seat. Karen Morgan's retiring from the Senate. She's a Democrat. Do you expect this to be a really competitive race, and are you treating it as such when you campaign?
Of course, this is an important race, both to me, to my family, and I believe to the people of Midvale, Murray, and Cottonwood Heights. Because it's so important, I believe, on a number of issues. This is a time when I believe that I can bring some unique perspectives in education, in healthcare, in jobs that are so unique and so timely for our people, for my constituents at this time. I'm working hard. We're working day and night on this in multiple areas. We have great bipartisan support in all three cities, and it's exciting. We have people just embracing this, and so, no, it's a wonderful time to be here. It's a great opportunity to serve, and frankly, I'm just excited and very hopeful in this as we go forth.
How are you getting to know the people of the district? Is it town hall meetings, door-to-door, all of the above?
You know, that's exactly right. We have walked the streets. We have gone to town hall meetings. We've had a chance to send out communications to people. And it's been a very, I got to say, very interesting, educational, and enlivening process.
We've been speaking with Dr. Brian Shiozawa. He's the immediate past president of the Utah Medical Association, and he's running for the Utah Senate in District 8. That includes cities like Cottonwood Heights, Midvale, and Murray, and his Democratic opponent is Josie Valdez. Dr. Shiozawa, it's been a great conversation here on Politics Up Close. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been great to be here with you today, too.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is Politics Up Close on KCPW. I'm Jeff Robinson. Senator Orrin Hatch could die in office if reelected. That was a message sent out in an email by the campaign of Democrat Scott Howell, who is Hatch's challenger this election year. And that message certainly didn't go unnoticed by Hatch's campaign. Thomas Burr is Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. He joins us every week for a roundup of Utah politics from the nation's capital and joins me now on the phone for an extended conversation here on Politics Up Close. And hi, Thomas. Thanks for being with us.
Of course, Jeff.
So, Thomas, how is Hatch's campaign responding to this claim that Hatch could die in office, what Howell is saying about his age?
You know, as you can imagine, that's not something that the Hatch office wanted to hear, or the Hatch campaign. I have not seen Senator Hatch since Scott Howell made the remark, but I just assume that the senator was a little upset by it. Dave Hansen, who is the campaign manager for the Hatch reelection effort, said, you know, hey, this is offensive not only to Hatch, but to anyone, quote, getting up in age. He didn't want to say the elderly. But his point is that if you're going to say he's going to die in office, you're offending a lot of the voters out there as well.
And we should note that although the Howell email said that Hatch is 80, he's actually 78, right? So kind of a difference mentally between perhaps how voters think of somebody who's 78 or 80 years old.
Yeah, a couple years do matter right there. And I have to say, you know, from what I understand when I'm talking to staffers over the years and covering Senator Hatch, you know, he's still the guy that gets up and is the office at, you know, 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, drives himself still. He works sometimes where staffers are complaining that they'd like to go home, and he still wants them to keep on, you know, trucking on. So, you know, he is definitely a hard worker here from what I've seen.
And you were able to catch up with Hatch's former colleague, former Senator Bob Bennett, who put an interesting spin on the issue. What did he have to say?
Well, I grabbed Senator Bennett was just upstairs this week at the National Press Club, so I stopped him and grabbed him outside the room and asked him, you know, what do you think about this? That's you know, you're actually 1 year older than Senator Hatch, and Bennett's response was, well, Scott Howell could die in office. You know, if he were to be elected, Scott Howell could die too, and Bennett, you know, had a couple of good points. There was a senator from Georgia, Paul Coverdell, that was elected to the Senate. He was 61 years old when he had a brain hemorrhage and died in office. Whereas Strom Thurmond from South Carolina was reelected to office at age 94 and actually finished his term out and died at age 100. So Bennett's point is that just because, you know, you're getting up in age, doesn't mean you're just going to, you know, die next year, that anyone could die at any age, and that's not the point.
Moving on, Thomas, you noticed something interesting on Twitter lately. It's something that I've picked up on a little bit, but it has to do with Utah's junior senator, Mike Lee, and how there seem to be a bunch of accounts that, you know, retweet his tweets or talk about what he says and talk about how great it is. And they all kind of have this same message as though there's some kind of copy and paste scheme going on here. You refer to it as astro-tweeting. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, there's a term in politics called astroturfing, but I think most people are probably familiar with the, you know, the fake grass that you find in some football fields nowadays. And astroturfing in politics means this kind of fake grassroots, that there really aren't that many people out there who are supporting the person, so they kind of make it look like there are people out there supporting someone. And I stumbled on this the other day when Senator Lee was testifying actually in a House committee. And somebody tweeted that he was a, quote, freaking constitutional ninja, which I thought was kind of clever. So I click in to see who was tweeting this and find that, you know, out of the, you know, 20, 30 tweets this person, this account had tweeted out, several were about Mike Lee and the rest were about, you know, strange, odd sports statistics, which, you know, just seemed a little, you know, odd for an account. I don't know many people who just follow one senator if they care about politics. And then I noticed there were several others like this. I think I found about six of them that have pretty much only talked about Lee. And if they talked about somebody else like Romney and Ryan, they were talking about Mike Lee talking about them. A couple of them had taken their same profile pictures from the same website, which was like a 1980s, you know, Arab rock band party of some sort. So it was a little odd. I did get one of them after I posted about a blog item about this. One of the accounts tweeted at me, calling me, let's just say some not so radio friendly words.
Oh,
but I still can't tell if it's a real person yelling at me or not. So I don't know if I should be upset.
Very interesting. Astro tweeting. You should copyright the term.
I should. TM.
So, Thomas, turning to one of Mitt Romney's least enthusiastic supporters, former Utah Governor John Huntsman and former competitor to Mitt Romney in the presidential race, you noted on Political Cornflakes this week that his PAC, I believe it's the Our Destiny PAC you're referring to, is closing up shop in Utah?
This is actually the Horizon PAC, which Our Destiny was his big super PAC he had federally, but the Horizon PAC was this fund that created by some Huntsman supporters way back in 2011 when there was hints that Huntsman was going to run for office, and they used this account to fund pretty much the quote unquote campaign in waiting. before Huntsman officially announced that he was going to run for president. You know, they raised, you know, a substantial amount of money. They paid a lot of consultants and staffers and kind of laid the groundwork. Well, obviously, John Huntsman's not running for president anymore. The supporters of his have closed the account, paid off all the bills, notified the election office in Utah that it's no longer going to be raising money. I guess the point of this is that there's not going to be a Huntsman 2013 campaign anytime soon.
We're speaking with Thomas Burr. He's Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics, here on Politics Up Close. Thomas, turning to the LDS Church, with Mitt Romney running for president as the Republican nominee, as in previous years, the church wants to get the message out there that, you know, it's not endorsing a candidate in the race, that it, you know, isn't aligned with the Republican Party and doesn't take positions on political candidates. But as you reported recently, there was an incident that caused the church to have to kind of reiterate this statement and make it clear to, you know, its members and to people outside the church that that is the case. What exactly happened and precipitated this statement from the church?
You know, this was first reported by John Ralston, who's a reporter in Nevada, and I picked up on it because I thought it was fascinating and an interesting look on exactly, you know, what happens out there, you know, in the field when, you know, the church can put out dictates and Romney's campaign can say this, but sometimes people get a little confused or maybe don't know the rules. In this case, it looks like there was kind of an overzealous Nevada church volunteer who was trying to, you know, bump up the voter registration and sent out a kind of a PowerPoint to several state presidents around the state to say, you know, here's what you can do to get people to register to vote and get out to vote. The problem was the contact for, you know, if they had any questions or if they needed some help with forms or those kind of things was a Mitt Romney supporter, which just kind of to some people strikes as a little too close to, you know, a problem with the church actually promoting Romney's campaign. The church was instantly, you know, came out with a statement saying that they, you know, are completely neutral in this, that they do not support, you know, any candidates, and then they have not, the church has obviously said many times before that they're, you know, great qualities of, you know, the church doctrine, beliefs that can be found in all different parties out there. So, you know, again, this is the church trying to reaffirm its neutrality, but when you're in the field, sometimes people go to a little bit of they maybe bend the rules a little bit or don't know the rules are there.
And Thomas, we'll turn to the campaign of Mitt Romney in just a moment here. But first, let's go back to Utah Senator Mike Lee. He certainly has more than once accused President Obama and his administration of violating the Constitution recently at a congressional hearing there. Now he's going after President Obama for, quote, abuse of power, which certainly the Democrats didn't stay silent on. What is Senator Lee's point here about President Obama's supposed abuse of power?
You know, this is something I think we've heard Senator Lee talk about for quite a while. He really summed it up, though, the other day. Again, he was testifying for the House Judiciary Committee, which was holding a hearing pretty much saying Obama had abused his executive branch power. In reality, you know, as you can see, a lot of people would just say this is a GOP dog and pony show, that you're calling, you know, three out of the four witnesses were very much GOP folks who were going after the president. Mike Lee believes there are, you know, several reasons the president's abuses power, from a recess appointment when the Senate wasn't in recess, to the Fast and Furious scandal, to, you know, abusing executive privilege. Those are those things that he kind of laid out. Of course, sprinkled with the good old Senator Lee style of citing the Federalist Papers and the Constitution down to the article and section and you know, all those kind of things. But you know, Lee was really kind of the star of this hearing, and he took some abuse from some of the Democrats for calling the president out on this stuff. The Democrats did not let up on him.
Now let's turn to the presidential campaign at Thomas and Mitt Romney, who was just this week here in Utah for a fundraiser and to do a quick little photo op with a local Boy Scout troop. Of course, the big news about Mitt Romney this week is the 47% comments he made at a fundraiser earlier this year and a secret videotape obtained by Mother Jones, the left-leaning news outlet, of him talking about how 47% of Americans pay no federal taxes. supposedly, and that they're all in Obama's camp. You know, they're a lost cause to his campaign, and they're, you know, not motivated to get themselves off public assistance. Well, of course, many people are talking about how this, you know, could devastate his campaign. Some people saying that this is, you know, that day they released the video was the day that Romney's campaign officially ended. But others are actually saying, I think Slate.com is the one making the point that this could help Romney in the GOP get some more votes. What's that argument from what you've heard?
You know, it's actually not a bad argument in some ways, because some of the concerns out there with the Romney campaign is getting the base of Republican voters excited to go to the polls on November 6th, that maybe that he's not necessarily the first choice of the party in many ways. He's not perfect for them. So he's not the motivating factor. The argument that Slate was making was that this helps cement his base, that there are a lot of Republicans out there, a lot of Republican voters who vote every time, who think that the nation is full of a bunch of quote unquote moochers.
Yeah.
You know, there are people out there who just want to live off the government dole. So you know, in some ways, this gets people excited. It gets some business people excited who think that there are problems in the welfare system that need to be addressed, and that's the argument that. You know, this helps him because this is going to fire up the base who are saying, you know what, finally someone said it.
But, of course, most political outlets, it seems, overwhelmingly are saying not a good thing for the Romney campaign, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. This was the silver lining, I guess, for Romney, if you can call it that. Most situations, most pundits I've talked to, most articles I've read, commentary, even from the very conservative side, are saying this is a pretty killer moment for Mitt Romney. They make it it's a gaffe akin to when President Barack Obama talked about Republicans clinging to their guns and their religion, and in so many ways this hurts because the 47% he's talking about, a lot of ways, are elderly people who survive on Social Security, or the troops serving abroad who don't pay any taxes. The 47% who don't pay taxes comes a lot of ways because of policies implemented by Republicans. The tax cuts pushed through by President Reagan, the tax cuts pushed through by President Bush, those things are what really has contributed to less people paying into the whole kitty.
And Thomas, Politico.com in particular has been reporting a lot about, what's going on in Romney's campaign and making it, it sounds like there's a lot of disarray there. Perhaps nobody fired from the campaign since its incident just yet. But what are you hearing there in Washington? And does it seem like his campaign is really getting shaken up, or is it just steady the course?
It always seems that when something goes wrong like this, that maybe when you have a little bit of a dip in the polls, that you get this quote unquote circular firing squad that people just start shooting at each other and realizing that they're actually hurting themselves all at one piece at one time. In this case, the big complaint was against Stuart Stevens, who was Mitt Romney's one of his top aides, kind of in charge of getting the convention speech done. And as the story goes, there was a convention speech written. He didn't like it, hired a couple other people. They didn't end up liking that. They kind of rewrote it themselves. They used one paragraph in the original one. And this is where you get the mess of, the wars not being mentioned, Afghanistan,
right?
Afghanistan not being mentioned, the troops not being mentioned. And that really there was just a really, a big screw up in the campaign, that it was kind of a last minute thing. This is something that always is going to happen with a campaign that's not doing so great, and people think that they know better, and so they're going to start blaming other people in the campaign. It's like I like to say when people ask me, who's going to win, there's a lot of green left. If you're talking golf or billiards, you may have the ball and you can see where you're supposed to put it, but there's a lot of space between there, and there's 47, 46 days left in the campaign, and there's three debates, fourth if you count the vice presidential debate. So you have a lot of things that could change this easily, economy numbers that could change it. So while the Romney campaign may be on the ropes a little bit, they could easily bounce back, and the president could screw up in a big way too. So there's a lot of things that can happen in that little bit of time.
Finally, Thomas, going back to the Republican National Convention and Clint Eastwood's infamous speech to an invisible President Obama sitting in a chair, you were part of the very beginning of a new internet sensation called Eastwooding. Your colleague Robert Gerke tweeted a picture of you talking to an empty chair there in Tampa, Florida. I must admit, I got in on the action too, posting a picture of myself to Facebook interviewing an empty chair here in the studio. What's it like being at the very beginning and saying you are one of the founders of Eastwooding, Tommy?
You know, I had no idea how much it would take off. It was one of those things that Robert and I just thought was kind of funny. I give full credit to him. It was his idea. I just happened to strike the right pose next to the right chair. But our friend Anna Marie Cox retweeted it to her 1.3 million followers, and the rest is history. And now we're, you know, BuzzFeed has a billion different links to people Eastwooding. You know, it's kind of fun. I was hoping to get a few more Twitter followers out of it, but that's okay. I actually had a good friend just gave me a gift of a coffee mug with a hashtag Eastwooding on it, which I'm now going to fill up with coffee, sit in an empty chair, and yell at for a little while.
Excellent. Thomas Burr is Washington correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune and author of Political Cornflakes, a daily online roundup of Utah politics. He has joined us today on Politics Up Close. Thomas, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Jeff.